little island to Palestine. Occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
I think we should take inspiration from the Palestinian street. You know, we can also do that within Palestinian civil society and Palestinian organizational spaces. It's about fostering an environment of like-minded organizations that work together, that have a clear politics and obvious red lines, but also where there is a space and room for people to grow, learn, and develop. And that also adopts this notion of care. This is Rethinking Palestine, a podcast from Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. We are a virtual think tank that aims to foster public debate on Palestinian human rights and self-determination. We draw upon the vast knowledge and experience of the Palestinian people, whether in Palestine or in exile, to put forward strong and diverse Palestinian policy voices. In this podcast, we will be bringing these voices to you so that you can listen to Palestinians sharing their analysis wherever you are in the world. This year, Shabaka has once again joined forces with McCann and Visualizing Palestine to build on the growing momentum for Palestinian rights across the globe. The three organizations have been looking to raise $60,000 to contribute to their ongoing work in strengthening the movement for Palestinian liberation. This collective spirit takes inspiration from the Unity Intifada of last year, which saw Palestinians defy their enforced fragmentation and unite across walls, blockades, and artificial borders in defiance against Israel's apartheid regime, and despite decades of settler colonialism, reminding the world that the Palestinian people's struggle is a unified one. Ashabaka, McCann and Visualizing Palestine are also working together, unified in our efforts to reclaim the narrative on Palestine to one that upholds freedom and justice. We all work in different ways, but with a shared goal of strengthening critical connections and producing and communicating Palestinian analysis in order to use them as tools in advocacy and beyond to challenge Israeli colonization and apartheid. In today's episode of Rethinking Palestine, we will be exploring these connections, looking at how our work intersects and how we can build stronger communities in the struggle for Palestinian liberation. Joining me to discuss all of this and more is Aline Patarse, Executive Director of Visualizing Palestine and a Shabaka board member, and Tamara Ben-Halim, Co-Director and Co-Founder of McCann. Thank you both of you for joining me today on Rethinking Palestine. Perhaps we can start off with an introduction of each organization and some examples of the work that you do. Let's start with Aline.
Thank you, Yara. It's really exciting to be in conversation with you and Tamara today. So Visualizing Palestine's focus is on developing data-led visuals that are aimed at advancing a right-based narrative of Palestine and Palestinians. We actually produced our first visual 10 years ago at a time when the use of infographics as an alternative form for social justice communication was not common at all, especially in the Palestinian context. Our visuals focus on data and storytelling at the same time. We know that a lot of research goes into the development of different types of research products, policy papers. Also, we have a lot of research that goes into our visuals as well. And we always make sure to cite the sources that we use and to make those accessible through our website. But the important part is that our visuals also tell a story. And they take a lot of creativity. What we want to do with our visuals is provoke thoughts and emotions that compel people to take action. So we work on visual storytelling because we know from research that learning that engages more of our senses, including with visual aids, help us retain information for a longer period of time. And with a lot of research on Palestine, we've also noticed that not everyone, you know, wants to read a 200-page report, right? Unless you're a policy analyst or a researcher. But a lot of people will take a look at visuals also in very fast-paced world that we live in. VP's visuals have Creative Commons licensing, which means that anyone can use our visuals, print and download them for free, and can use them for awareness raising as well as advocacy tools around Palestine. VP importantly works both independently and in partnership with Palestinian and international human rights organizations to produce visual tools to serve a wide community of advocates, human rights defenders, academics, educators, and students to help them communicate about issues impacting Palestine and Palestinians. I think, you know, one thing I'd like to emphasize is that we see a lot of people that are often told that Palestine is complicated or too complex for an average person to understand, and that they shouldn't even try to bother to form an informed opinion. And one of the things that Israel tries to do intentionally is to complicate the reality with propaganda and strategic fragmentation. And we believe that anyone can and must understand the root cause of oppression, particularly in countries that are complicit in Palestinian oppression. They have a specific responsibility in learning more and in being able to advocate. So our visuals, what our visuals do is that they attempt to take complex data and information and distill them into visually compelling resources. And VP has a large collection of infographics, almost 200 infographics on the impact of settler colonialism on Palestinians. VP has also developed some videos and educational platform, including Palestine, Visualizing Palestine 101, Palestine Journeys, Palestine Open Maps, and the growth of a movement timeline that documents wins and of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement since it started in 2006. And maybe I'll just end with just some examples of what we've been working on over the past year. So about a year ago, we collaborated with Human Rights Watch on their Crime of Apartheid report, and we developed several visuals on what the crime of apartheid means. And we have four vignettes on what it means to be born as a Palestinian in Jerusalem, the West Bank, the Naqab, and abroad, and then comparing what those discriminatory policies, Israel's discriminatory policies and practices mean for Palestinians versus Jews, and how basically Israel ensures racial domination of Jews over Palestinians by implementing these practices and policies. We've actually been producing visuals on apartheid for a very long time. And most recently, we also developed an additional visual with Al-Haq, Al-Mizan, and Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies on Israel's use of strategic fragmentation as a tool to divide and dominate the Palestinian people. So I just wanted to share these couple of examples, and I'll stop there.
Thank you, Aline, for sharing the important work that Visualizing Palestine does. Over to you, Tamara.
Thank you to Yara and El Shabaka for having us today. And it's always wonderful to be in your company and in the company of Visualizing Palestine as well. So I'm co-founder and co-director of McCann. McCann is a UK-based Palestinian-led educational organization. We started conceptualizing the idea behind McCann around 2015 and started our pilot workshops in 2016. The reason why McCann was started really goes back to the aftermath of the 2014 attacks on Gaza, when there was a sense that several of us had that although more Palestinian voices were starting to be heard in the mainstream media and in other fora, that there was still, generally speaking, a very problematic narrative across most arenas that really failed to take into account basic structural power imbalances, a lack of an understanding of Israel as an apartheid state and Palestine as an anti-colonial struggle. And we really wanted to use our position as Palestinians in the diaspora to be able to contribute to pushing the narrative in the right direction. So during this time, we did a lot of research and did a lot of mapping out of what other brilliant organizations and initiatives were doing. And we found that there was a real niche for specifically educational training, capacity and skill building that invests in and supports young advocates who are speaking out on Palestine and also on other social justice and human rights issues more broadly. So the ultimate goal of McCann has really always been to equip people, specifically young people, but also more established advocates and campaigners. And I'll speak a little bit about our audiences in a moment, with the tools, the knowledge, and especially the confidence that they need to be able to help shift the broad conversation on Palestine across grassroots advocacy, university campuses, and policy spheres to one that upholds freedom, justice, and equality for Palestinians. So a brief example of some of the core of the work that we do. I've mentioned that we do educational training. What that really looks like is the curation of specific educational programs, what we call workshops or tailored training, that really focus on getting people up to speed. Not that they have to be experts in any way, but getting them up to speed of having a basic knowledge of what the contemporary Palestinian rights struggle looks like, what what the history of the struggle is that has led us to where we are today, what apartheid as a crime under international law means, why it's appropriate for us to understand Israel's regime as an apartheid regime, and then really taking the practical aspects of that knowledge and putting that into practice by learning how to really talk about the Palestinian issue in effective ways that counter so much of the propaganda that exists and that we've particularly seen most recently. Those are our general workshops on Palestine, on Palestinian rights, that are targeted at young advocates, at university students, but also at trade unions and trade union leaders, as well as grassroots and social justice leaders. We're also branching out to work more specifically with journalists and policymakers as of this year. While our work is focused mostly in Britain, we're also, because of the shift towards virtual and remote work, all our work is currently online, and that has enabled us to be able to reach across North America, on the East Coast and Canada in particular, and elsewhere in Europe and in the Middle East. So that's generally kind of the workshops that we run. We also run trainings that we call tailored training that is more kind of specific to the needs of specific groups of people. So we may have a group or an organization or institution that wants support on a specific aspect of the advocacy or communications work that they're doing around Palestine. And they would come to us to help curate a training that is really tailored to their needs as well. And this is in addition to broader work that we do around developing educational resources, posts on social media. And we also have an upcoming online course on the contemporary Palestinian struggle that's being launched in partnership with the Institute for Palestine Studies in the next couple of months. I think I will leave it there. We can speak more about kind of the collaboration that we do with one another in the next questions.
Tamara, thank you so much for telling us about McCann's important work. I'm going to share just a little bit about Shabaka because I'm sure most of our listeners are already aware of who we are and what we do Ashabaka is an independent transnational think tank. We have a network of over 200 Palestinian experts and specialists in all different fields based all over the world, including public health experts, engineers, architects, academics, lawyers, environmental workers, and so many more. The aim of Ashabaka is to draw upon the vast knowledge and experience of the Palestinian people, whether under occupation, in exile, or in the 48 territories, so as to engage a broad spectrum of perspectives in debate on policy and strategy. We also work to get Palestinian expert voices in policy spaces and spaces where they can influence decision makers. And to this end, we publish policy analysis in the form of briefs, memos and commentaries in both English and Arabic. We cover topics such as apartheid, climate change, leadership, governance, representation, and so much more. We also engage in other forms of multimedia, such as webinars, and we have, of course, a monthly podcast called Rethinking Palestine, in order to promote our members' policy analysis in a variety of different formats. Our audience is also quite wide and includes activists, journalists, civil society organizations, lobbyists, diplomats, politicians, and students. And we have now become really a very wide network. Indeed, our members are present in most spaces where Palestine is discussed. This is obviously because of their own expertise and credentials, but at Ashabaka, we also work with our members to access these spaces and to make sure that Palestinian voices are in these spaces, because it's been the case for so long that Palestine is written about, analysed and discussed without Palestinians in the room. And our hope at Ashabaka is that we're showing that Palestinians can analyse, and they have been analysing, and they refuse to be marginalised. And of course, we are not the first or the only organisation to do this. If you're enjoying this podcast, please visit our website, www.al-shabaka.org, where you will find more Palestinian policy analysis and where you can join our mailing list and donate to support our work. Now on to our second question. Where do you see yourself and your organisation in the ecosystem of organisations working towards Palestinian liberation? Let's start with Tamara this time.
Yeah, so I think there's obviously such a rich ecosystem around us of organizations working on Palestine, and new and old, that each kind of contribute something really, really important at different levels. And I think it's really important to understand movements as, although coordination is always good, you need all of the different efforts and all of the different initiatives, because no one organization and no one effort, no one approach is going to, on its own, bring us the freedom that we're and the justice that we're working towards. So with that in mind, in terms of where McCann comes in, I think, you know, to be able to do campaigning work, to be able to do advocacy work, and the most effective organizing and mobilizing that you can do, you need some level of knowledge and confidence. You absolutely don't need to be any kind of expert. You don't have to have a PhD. You don't even have to have a master's. But to be able to think about how to talk about the issue in effective ways, in the ways that Palestinians are talking about the issues, to be able to uphold the demands of Palestinians, to think about the different pressure points, to think about what the most effective strategies are in your campaigning work. All of this requires some level of basic knowledge and skills and capacities in communication as well. And this is really where CAN comes in. So we haven't seen really any other organizations that are focused exclusively on intensive education with an academic rigor on Palestine that are really working to invest in advocates' knowledge and learning on the issue. So this kind of political education, we know there is a huge need for it, particularly now, given the quote-unquote shrinking of space that is happening in Britain, in Europe, in the United States, and elsewhere. And when we talk about shrinking space, that's really jargon for just saying that, you know, spaces for speaking openly about Palestine and advocating for Palestinian liberation are in many ways closing because of attacks that we're witnessing from pro-Israel organizations, from Israel and its allies, that are making it extremely difficult, whether it's someone posting social media on Instagram, whether it's a university student trying to organize at their local student union, whether it's an academic putting together a course on Palestine and the States. All of these things, we're witnessing greater and greater attacks. And that, I think, reinforces the need for the type of political education and confidence building work that McCann does. Although there's increasing solidarity with Palestine across the board from social justice movements and activists, which is a wonderful thing to see, at the same time, we're also seeing a huge chilling effect. And that is something that McCann, along with other organizations, is trying to address very carefully, particularly in Britain. Because, of course, the last thing we want is for people to be too scared and underconfident to be able to speak up, even though they want to. So our work is really about helping them to be able to gain the confidence and the tools to do that. So just to answer the question directly in terms of where we are in the ecosystem, I think we're somewhere between, although it's not so linear, somewhere between kind of the academic sphere and campaigning and advocacy. So to be able to do that campaigning and advocacy work, to be able to do the speaking on media platforms, we hope the work that we do and the interventions that we make, it help people to do that, to take that next step more effectively.
Tamara, what you said at the beginning of your answer about the movement needing to be pluralistic and have a multi-layered approach is so important. Aline, what do you think about this?
Thank you, Yara, and thank you, Tamara. Everything really that you said resonates quite a bit, and I completely agree with you also that there is no one organization alone that can bring the freedom that we're all working towards, especially with the increased attacks that we see from Israel on nonprofits, minimalization of 6 organizations, but that we also know that this is not new. They're just amplifying the efforts that they use to suppress freedom of speech of Palestinians. And I think also the stronger we get and the more united we get, they try to divide us even more with all the tactics that they're using. And so the strategic fragmentation is on all levels, really. And yet we remain strong. So it's really beautiful that we're all in partnership together. And I think, you know, what I'll say is also in terms of where visualizing Palestine fits into the ecosystem, we really see ourselves play a very, very specific role in the ecosystems of organizations working towards Palestinian liberation. We see our visuals as tools and educational resources that can be used by others in the movement, including academics, students, activists, anyone really that wants to raise awareness and that wants to advocate around Palestine. I think the biggest group we've seen use our visuals are students in universities. From our records, we've seen more than 100 universities use our visuals. So they're really, the academic arena is a really a huge place where we see our visuals used, but they're of course used beyond that as well. And, you know, we don't see our visuals as an end in and of themselves. And this is why we collaborate with other organizations and activists to continuously identify priorities and make sure that our visuals are useful for campaigns that are being carried out by other groups and organizations in the movement. And, you know, we also talked about this, that, you know, there's such a huge volume of information being produced on Palestine. And sometimes it's overwhelming. It's in some ways an over-researched context, while at the same time, research is being silenced, buried, and countered by Israeli propaganda. So we at CP, you know, want to make a contribution to knowledge production by disseminating information in a creative medium. So we're just one of these organizations, basically, that are producing visuals as an important alternative source of information, because traditional forms of media have historically excluded Palestinian voices. So it's the Israeli government in tandem with the Western media and with countries that are complicit with Israeli policies. And I will just share this one piece of research that I came across recently, a study by Maha Nassar in 2020 that revealed that non-Palestinians wrote 99% of opinion pieces about Palestinians published by the Washington Post, over a period of basically between 1970 and 2019. So even if this is not a perception, there are statistics around Palestinians being literally excluded from media. And then that was with the Washington Post, the New York Times didn't do much better. There were less than 2% of opinion pieces that were published, that were written by Palestinians. So, our voices are being excluded. We're being referred to in the passive voice and opinion pieces. There is violent language that's being used to describe Palestinians. So all of this is really impacting the opinion that people in different countries make around Palestine and the Palestinian struggle. And we saw this most recently with how mainstream media was reporting on the murder of Shireen Abu Akleh. There was language that was being used to refer to her in the passive voice, saying that she has died, not saying who killed her. And this is important because a lot of people don't even read past those headlines. So we see ourselves as one Palestinian-led platform that centers Palestinian experiences and that really works in tandem with Al Shabaka, with McCann, with a lot of other amazing Palestinian organizations that are really working to change the narrative on Palestine.
Aline, those stats that you mentioned about op-eds is really stark and not surprising at all. But I think when you hear the numbers, it really sticks with you. Al Shabaka works in tandem with other organizations in contributing to changing the narrative on Palestine and making sure that Palestinian voices are heard in mainstream spaces. Indeed, we are one of the few Palestinian think tanks, and as such, I think we are contributing to much needed policy analysis written by Palestinians that can challenge what is usually written about us and for us. And I think we're producing knowledge, and there are so many great organizations that also do that, like Jadalia and the Institute of Palestine Studies. But our particular focus is on policy, and I think that's particularly beneficial to those working in advocacy and lobbying. And at Shabaka, really hope that the pieces that we're publishing provide material tools and resources for many of our partner organizations. Something else you mentioned, Aline, was identifying collective priorities, and that's so important. Shabaka, for example, partners sometimes come to us and ask us for specific policy analysis. They might be working on a specific policy angle, lobbying politicians or running a campaign, and they are in need of Palestinian written analysis. And this is something that we can provide. Or if our partners are working on a specific topic and they want it highlighted, we are always happy to uplift that work or produce more materials on that specific topic. But I think there are always ways to improve our working together. And that brings me on to my next question. Last year, during the Unity Intifada, we saw examples of Palestinians working together in inspiring shows of unity. For example, collectives organizing legal support and representation for those arrested by Israeli regime forces, neighborhood defense committees, group fielding media and sharing talking points. What do you think we can learn from that moment moving forward, and how can we work better together? I'll start with Tamara again.
I'll answer this one briefly because I think there was a lot to be inspired by, obviously, from there always is, but particularly in this moment of unity and defiance that came from Palestinians, from the general strike, from the Dignity and Hope Manifesto, from seeing Palestinians from Haifa to Gaza show actions of brotherhood, sisterhood, solidarity with their siblings in Jerusalem. And I'm sure we all, as Palestinians and as non-Palestinians, were hugely moved by this. I think what we can learn from this, obviously different parts of the Palestinian movement, and maybe particularly abroad, have been fragmented over time. I think we can't ignore that reality. I think the good thing is that, at least here in Britain, and I feel in the States as well, Aline can respond to that better than me, in recent years that is changing. There is increasing collaboration and genuine and strategic partnership. There is a lot of meaningful close work happening between organizations within the movement and, of course, beyond, with more broadly with other social justice groups, be they indigenous collectives, be they anti-racist organizers and others. In terms of what I think is practical for, you know, how we can work more effectively as organizations, the struggle I think that we normally have as McCann is making the time and the mental space for it. There's always a feeling of urgency. There's always a feeling of go, go, go. And, you know, it's difficult to ever pause, and you need to pause. And we all need to pause in this work, both to avoid burnout, to take care of ourselves and one another, but also to allow creative thought to happen. And I think you really need that when you're thinking about collaboration, because collaboration, it can happen naturally, but I think it's also, if you don't make space for it, it doesn't happen. So you really need to kind of look beyond the immediacy and the internal, you know, operations of your organization and the day-to-day details that you get bogged down in, to be able to think more with more perspective. So I think for us, and for me in particular, you know, making time and space for collaboration is really the thing that enables it to happen. So really having that intention, I think, is absolutely necessary. I think more broadly speaking, in terms of the movement, I think ideally, obviously, you have the same principles and values, but also it's okay not to agree on absolutely everything. To be able to unite for a broader goal of collective liberation. So as long as you have the basic shared principles and values, I think it's important to also be strategic to an extent in order to come together to help strengthen the movement and its efforts.
Over to you, Aileen.
Thank you, Tamara. And yeah, you mentioned a lot of really important points about how we're also seeing the world changing, right? Because I think we're exposed to social media and we're all in this virtual world together, that our stories are being heard by people and by communities who are also oppressed, including Black Americans and Indigenous groups, you know, so there's just so much to build on. It's really inspiring, I think, you know, and it has been going for a while, but I feel like our issues and, you know, this whole thing around, we really cannot be liberated. We have to work around joint liberation together. I'm very inspired. I feel like on a daily basis, I have to remind myself of this quote from Angela Davis that says, you have to act as if it were possible to radically transform the world, and you have to do it all the time. And it's not easy, but I feel like for me, it's a source of inspiration, and I have to remind myself of it all the time because we have to imagine that a different world is possible, and we have to work towards it. And I think, just to answer the question, Yara, around, you know, what do we learn moving forward from the Unity Intifada? And for me, the biggest, most important lesson is that unity is possible despite Israel's fragmentation, despite everything that Israel is doing to make sure that we do not unite, that it is united. And of course, you know, despite the Palestinian Authority's complicity as well in making sure that the status quo remains the same. So you've talked about this a lot, Yara, in your analysis as well. Last year during the Unity Intifada, Palestinians with Israeli citizenship basically, you know, worked around organizing the general strike. And because they are such a huge part of the Israeli workforce, it really impacted the economy, you know. For I feel like there's just so much that we can do to build on it. It just needs the persistence and the patience. And we need to, and this is why our work together, I think, is very important, because we have to have sort of the patience for it to make it happen. And I feel like it's not an overstatement to say that, because it does take time, and it does take ability to take our imagination to a different place and to think of a better future that is a future of freedom for everyone. And I think we also saw this so clearly during the funeral for our beloved Shireen on May 13th. Despite all of Israeli restrictions, the military checkpoints they set up to prevent mourners from joining the funeral, from attacking Palestinian mourners carrying Shireen's coffin, to arresting mourners that were carrying the Palestinian flag, Palestinians still united in love and in pain. And I don't think I've ever seen Jerusalem, you know, this Palestinian, it was such a beautiful moment, even though, of course, it was full of sorrow. But, you know, we see what we can do when we really unite and get together, and that we can defy Israel's fragmentation. And it's in no way easy. But I do think that this persistence is very important. This faith in ourselves is really important.
Aline, you mentioned Shireen Abu Akleh's funeral in Jerusalem and how, despite the horror of her killing, it showed once again a united front of Palestinians. Indeed, in death, Shireen united Palestinians in a way that few political movements have been able to do. Scenes that I never thought I would see in my lifetime. Jaffa Gate flooded with Palestinian flags and Palestinians chanting for a free Palestine was so incredibly moving and inspiring, as well as deeply poignant. And I think many of us felt like that with those scenes, we were getting a glimpse of what a liberated Palestine could look like. But back to this question of working together. Palestinian civil society orgs, both in Palestine and around the world, are working in very close quarters. You know, we often cover the same topics, organize similar events, etc. And as such, we often go after the same funding, the same supporters, the same employees even. And I think this kind of environment can foster a competitiveness and even sometimes resentment. And I don't necessarily think that's always by coincidence. I think there are forces at work that are trying to distract us from the work that we have to do. And what we saw during the Unity Intifada was Palestinians coming together from the bottom up to resist Israeli settler colonialism. It wasn't a unity or an organizing that came from NGOs, or political parties. It was the Palestinian street organizing in a way that directly responded to events on the ground that was built on decades of organizing and political work. And this was what was so inspiring. It showed that we still have the capacity to resist and organize. And I think we should take inspiration from the Palestinian street. You know, we can also do that within Palestinian civil society and Palestinian organizational spaces. It's about fostering an environment of like-minded organizations that work together, that have a clear politics and obvious red lines, but also where there is a space and room for people to grow, learn, and develop. And that also adopts this notion of care. Now, before we end, I want to let our listeners know that Ashabaka, McCann, and Visualizing Palestine are currently raising funds to support our collective work, expand our reach further, and strengthen the global movement for Palestinian liberation. You can support us by visiting al-shabaka.org/donate now or anytime before June 16th. Thank you, Aline and Tamara, once again for joining me on Rethinking Palestine.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure being in conversation with both of you, and always really love working with you and collaborating on many different levels. Thank you so much, Yara, for hosting us.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Yara and Ashabaka and Aline and Vivi.
Thank you for listening to Rethinking Palestine. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. For more policy analysis and to donate to support our work, please visit our website, www.al-shabaka.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you.
military checkpoints, Jewish-only roads and towns, color-coded ID cards, and a separate set of laws for Palestinians and Israelis. This is the reality of life for millions of Palestinians living under Israeli control, from the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem to Israel and the Gaza Strip. Palestinians are living under a system of laws and rules that discriminate against them based on one principal factor, the fact that they are Palestinian. It's a reality that many have likened to apartheid South Africa, where the colonial white minority ruled over the indigenous black population through institutionalized racial segregation. During apartheid-era South Africa, black South Africans were forced to carry ID cards wherever they went, their movement was severely restricted, and they were relegated to living in impoverished Bantustans. When they tried to rise up against these racist policies, they were violently suppressed and imprisoned en masse. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? So, what is apartheid? Under international law, it's a crime against humanity that isn't actually unique to South Africa. It's defined as the inhumane acts committed in the context of an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over another, committed with the intention of maintaining that regime. So, if apartheid isn't unique to South Africa, does it apply to Israel and Palestine? Well, rights groups say that it does. For decades, Palestinians have called out explicit practices of Israeli apartheid against them in the occupied territory and within Israel itself. Over the past year, more rights groups have joined the calls to end Israeli apartheid, including leading Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, Human Rights Watch, and most recently, Amnesty International. So let's take a look at Israeli apartheid. While Israeli apartheid manifests itself in many different ways, it can be easily understood through geographic location. Since 1948, Israel has divided and carved up historic Palestine into different units, all under a certain degree of control by the Israeli state. Even in places like the West Bank and Gaza, where the Palestinian Authority and Hamas maintain certain levels of bureaucratic control, everything else is controlled by Israel. From the borders and population registry to essential resources like water and electricity. There are an estimated 7 million Palestinians and 7 million Jews living in the area between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. Jewish persons can largely treat the entire territory as one and are free to move between its borders and live with full rights wherever they choose. Palestinians, however, face a very different reality. Palestinians have largely been split up into five major geographic locations. Israel, the occupied Palestinian territory, which includes East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza, and the diaspora, where millions of Palestinian refugees live in exile, banned from returning to their homes. In each of these places, Israel maintains a set of laws that favor the rights of one set of people, Jews, over another, Palestinians. One of the primary ways that Israel separates Palestinians and maintains domination over them is through its control of the population registry and ID system. By controlling the registry, Israeli authorities have the power to restrict every aspect of Palestinian life, from determining where Palestinians are allowed to live, who they're able to marry, and what services they do and do not have access to. For Palestinians, the type of ID you carry dictates the level of rights that you have and to which degree your life is controlled by the Israeli state and security apparatus. For example, Palestinians living in the West Bank have a different ID than Palestinians living in Israel and are thus subject to a different set of laws. But in both cases, the rights of the Palestinians in these areas are inferior to those of Jewish persons living in those same places. This is Palestinian human rights expert, Rania Muharib.
Through this ID system, Palestinians have been systematically fragmented, and fragmentation plays an essential role in the establishment of apartheid. Palestinians are deprived of the right to meet, to live together, to group, or to exercise any collective rights. Their rights essentially depend on the status imposed on them by Israel.
You can think about it like a tiered system, where the lower you go, the less rights you have. On the top tier, you have Jewish Israelis, who have full rights under the law and are free to live throughout Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory, with the exception of Gaza. Next, you have Palestinian citizens of Israel, who carry Israeli passports and have the right to vote in Israeli elections. While they enjoy more freedoms than Palestinians in the occupied territory, Palestinian citizens of Israel are treated as second-class citizens compared to Israeli Jews.
They face institutionalized discrimination in accessing professions. They receive inferior services, receive less public allocations, budget allocations, and they face discriminatory planning and zoning, which essentially applies on both sides of the Green Line.
Next up, you have Palestinians living in occupied East Jerusalem, who carry blue ID cards and are given permanent residency status, which can be revoked by the state at any time. Further down the line are Palestinians in the West Bank who carry green ID cards. They live under Israeli military rule and have no rights under the law. Palestinians here live in a series of non-contiguous enclaves separated by Israeli checkpoints, walls, and settlements that restrict their every move. In Gaza, Palestinians also carry green ID cards but face even further restrictions on their movement. Since 2007, Israel has upheld a land, air, and sea blockade that has crippled Gaza, making it uninhabitable as of 2020, according to the UN. Lastly, come Palestinian refugees living in exile, who have no form of ID and are barred by Israel from returning to their historic homelands.
By looking at the situation in such a fragmented manner, this also serves Israel's apartheid regime of dividing Palestinians and preventing them from exercising collective rights.
Now that we've broken down how Israel divides Palestinians both geographically and through its ID system, we can take a look at the different ways that Israel applies its apartheid system to the Palestinians in those areas. As Beit Selem pointed out in its report on Israeli apartheid, one of the primary ways Israel maintains its regime is through its land policies. Israel largely treats land as a resource that serves to benefit the Jewish people. At the same time, the state uses restrictive policies to corral Palestinians into small enclaves through the expropriation and confiscation of their land. Even when you look at who has the right to build on the land, that right is almost always reserved for Jews, not Palestinians. But these racist land policies are not relegated to the occupied Palestinian territory. In fact, they're widely practiced inside Israel as well. In the decades since 1948, Israel has approved the construction of hundreds of new towns for its Jewish communities. Yet not a single new community has been approved for its Palestinian citizens, who make up 20% of the population. Palestinian citizens of Israel have only been given access to less than 3% of the country's total area for their communities and local councils. Experts say these discriminatory land policies that favor Jews over Palestinians are essential to understanding Israeli apartheid.
The effort to uproot Palestinians forms part of a broader settler colonial logic of replacing indigenous Palestinians with Jewish settlers. And so the transfer of Palestinians from their lands and properties, which is a process that, as we know, is ongoing, has served both to establish apartheid and to continuously maintain it over Palestinians.
To see these harmful policies in action, one has to look no further than the town of Jisr al-Zarqa, a small fishing village in northern Israel and the last remaining Palestinian village on the Mediterranean coast outside of Gaza. Surrounded by wealthy Israeli towns, the impoverished Jisr al-Zarqa is a stark example of Israeli apartheid. It's home to an estimated 15,000 Palestinians and is one of the poorest towns in Israel, with about 80% of residents living below the poverty line. Jisr al-Zarqa is surrounded on all four sides, which prevent the village from expanding. To the north is a Jewish kibbutz and an Israeli nature reserve. To the south is the upscale Israeli town of Caesarea, which was built on the rubble of a Palestinian village in 1952. It's home to former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and boasts upscale amenities like a golf course, harbor, archaeological site, and an industrial business park. To the east of Jisr al-Zarqa is Highway 2, which was constructed by Israel in the 1960s and cut the residents of the town off from hundreds of acres of their historical farmlands. And to the west is the Mediterranean Sea. Just like in the occupied territory, Palestinian citizens of Israel, like those living in Jisr al-Zarqa, are subject to detrimental zoning policies that force many people to build without permits, and thus subjecting them to home demolitions. While the government refuses to approve new construction in Jisr al-Zarqa, Israeli planning authorities have provided sufficient land and zoning permissions to the neighboring Jewish towns in order to facilitate their growth. So far, we've looked at how Israel divides and fragments Palestinians geographically through color-coded ID systems and harmful land and zoning policies. But Israel's apartheid policies don't stop there. Another way that Israel separates Palestinians and maintains its domination is through citizenship and immigration laws, which once again favor Jews and discriminate against Palestinians. After the Nakba in 1948, Israel expropriated hundreds of thousands of acres of Palestinian land and gave it to its new Jewish citizens who came from around the world. At the same time, it instituted a number of laws that prevented the Palestinians who it had made refugees and their descendants, who now number over 5 million, from ever returning to their homelands. While international law requires the right of return for Palestinian refugees, the state has continued to deny that right until today and largely bans Palestinians from visiting the country, even as tourists. This is Amin al-Ashkar, a Palestinian refugee living in Lebanon.
We're being denied to go into this land because of who we are. And that's the whole thing around apartheid, right? Being denied something that it is a right for you based on who you are or your ethnicity or your religion or whatever. We're denied to go into Palestine just because we are Palestinians. And I don't know if that's not apartheid, what is apartheid?
While Palestinian refugees are unable to return to their homes, Jewish persons from around the world can actually immigrate freely to Israel and even become citizens, even if they've never stepped foot in the country before.
Israeli legislation allows settlers, Jewish settlers, whether they hold Israeli citizenship or not, to live throughout the territory, and this obviously contributes to the further displacement and dispossession of Palestinians. So you can see how the law systematically favors Jewish Israelis over Palestinians wherever they reside.
Israel's control of Palestinian lives extends far beyond borders, checkpoints, and documents. For tens of thousands of Palestinian families, the state controls intimate parts of their family lives, who they can marry, what kind of rights their children will have, and if they can even live together as a family. For decades, Israel upheld a ban on family unification, and in 2022, they passed it into law. The law denies naturalization to Palestinians from the occupied West Bank or Gaza who are married to Israeli citizens, forcing thousands of Palestinian families to either emigrate or live apart. Essentially, it means that if a Palestinian citizen of Israel married someone from the West Bank or Gaza, their spouse will not have the right to live with them in Israel and become a citizen.
Through this process, Palestinians are deprived of the right to live together, and they're deprived of the right to family life, choice of spouse, and equality in marriage. And these policies are, of course, consistent with some of the inhuman acts that are listed under the Apartheid Convention.
Such laws also present barriers to Palestinians from different units within the occupied Palestinian territory from falling in love, getting married, and starting a family. For example, if a Palestinian from East Jerusalem fell in love with a Palestinian from the West Bank, the West Bank resident cannot legally go to live in East Jerusalem with their spouse because Israeli law prevents it. And if the spouse from East Jerusalem were to move to the West Bank, Israel would revoke their permanent residency in the city, making them stateless. Even their future children would face legal obstacles when it comes to getting residency status. In this video, we've taken a look at how Israel imposes apartheid on Palestinians in every aspect of their lives and wherever they live. Whether you're a citizen of Israel or a resident of Gaza, so long as you are Palestinian, your rights are inferior to the rights of Jews. Beyond its ID system, land, citizenship, and immigration policies, Israel continues to oppress Palestinians every day in the form of home demolitions, arrests, imprisonment, and extrajudicial killings. Even when Palestinians try to challenge Israel's apartheid policies, they are criminalized and attacked by the Israeli government.
When we talk about a system of apartheid under international law, we're talking about a series of human rights violations that are committed with a specific intention. And that intention is to maintain racial domination over a group. In this case, Palestinians are systematically deprived of their rights, both collective and, in many cases, individual rights.
So now that more human rights groups are joining the call to end Israeli apartheid, what comes next?
At the end of the day, apartheid allows Palestinians to better articulate the nature of the oppression that is imposed on them as a people. And through that, collective action can be taken to counter this institutionalized oppression.
So that's it for us for today. You're listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Politica is thrilled to announce the theatrical release of Dear Jackie, a feature documentary by Henri Pardo. The film opens on June 17 in 4 theaters in Montreal: Cinéma Public, Cinéma du Musée, Cinémathèque Québécoise, and Cinéma Moderne, with the director and special guests in attendance at select screenings. Dear Jackie poetically tells the story of one of the oldest black communities in Canada, Montreal's Little Burgundy, by way of a cinematic letter to Jackie Robinson, the first black man to break the color barrier in professional baseball. It also masterfully connects history to the present by challenging the myth of a post-racial society. This release is co-presented by Desta Black Youth Network, Tyndale St. George's Community Center, Canteen Bergs, and Makisia Solo. For more information and tickets, visit cinemapolitica.org. We hope to see you there. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
following is a previously broadcast program.
Page audio pour vos proches à l'intérieur.
This one goes out to you.